From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For a good part of his life, Tom Christofferson couldn't reconcile his sexuality with his religion. When he came out to his friends and family, he says he wanted to be honest about his life, and he figured the only way to do that was to leave the church. So he asked to be excommunicated. He was. In those days, just being gay was seen as a moral failing in Mormonism. But the church's stand is more complicated these days, and when Tom Christofferson saw a way back into his church a few years ago, he wanted to take it. But he knew it would mean choosing his faith over the love of his life, a man he spent nearly 20 years with. Today in the program, Christofferson is joining us to explain his choice and how being Mormon was as central to his identity as being gay. Join us after the news.
Support for this Radio West podcast comes from Salt Lake County Animal Services, a no-kill municipal shelter specializing in pet adoptions, licensing, humane education, and more. Located at 511 West, 3900 South in Salt Lake City. More information is at AdoptUtahPets.com.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When news of the LDS Church's policy about same-sex couples broke in November of 2015, a lot of people close to this issue wondered what would happen to Tom Christofferson, or those like him. Christofferson is gay and a Latter-day Saint, and he had returned to his church, had been embraced by his local leaders and congregation, but the policy seemed gratuitous and cruel to some. It declared couples and same-sex unions apostates and deprived their children of membership in the church. Christofferson had already left his relationship to return to Mormonism, which required him to live a celibate life without a romantic partner. And people wondered how he or other LGBT Latter-day Saints would react now. In a new memoir, Christofferson says he couldn't wrap his mind around it. We should point out another reason people thought of Tom is because of his brother Todd, who's in the Quorum of the 12 Apostles of the LDS Church. Tom Christofferson is joining us today to talk about the stories he tells in his book. He touches on the policy, but mostly he says he wanted to write a book for families of gay Mormons like him. The book is called That We May Be One, A Gay Mormon's Perspective on Faith and Family. Tom Christofferson spent his career in investment management. He's a founding member of Encircle. It's a group that supports LGBTQ youth and their families in Provo. He's speaking on Thursday in Salt Lake City. We'll give you details about that as we go along. His book is published by Deseret Book, and that Deseret Book part is where we began the conversation. I want to get a few things out of the way in terms of the relationship with Deseret Book.
Right.
Clearly, you wrote this book, but I guess the question is, what was your arrangement with Deseret Book? Did you have to agree to portray the church in a positive light? Did you have to agree to leave details with your brother out of the story? I mean, what was the arrangement like, if there was one?
The way it all started was actually a lunch conversation with Sherry Dew, where we were talking about, you know, my background and family and experience. And she said, you know, we ought to find a way to tell the story more broadly. And I said, well, I've always wanted to write a book. So that's where the book came from. I have to tell you, I've been very surprised at how little editing was done to the way that I wanted to tell my story. So there was one case where I was trying to make a point that they felt was not being made very effectively. We went over that about three different ways.
Yeah.
And finally, I found a different way to tell it that everybody seemed to think would work. So that was the only case.
So you got a bit of pushback, but not too much.
One place. That was it.
So I want to get this part out of the way, too. Your story is compelling and it's beautiful. But of course, let's be honest, one of the reasons why people are paying attention to this story is because your brother happens to be in, you know, some of the highest positions in the LDS Church. How did you reckon with that? Are you comfortable with that part of it? And what did you say to your brother about the idea of doing a book like this? And what did he make of it?
Yeah. I have four older brothers. So Todd is the oldest in our family, and I'm the youngest. And as I was writing the book, I sent chapters as I finished them to each one of my brothers because I wanted them to tell me if there was something they knew that I didn't know, particularly about how our mom and dad reacted, that, you know, they might have said something to my brothers they didn't say to me. and also to see if there was something that they thought I was remembering inaccurately.
Yeah.
So they all, you know, they all gave me feedback, including Todd. But you know, Todd really felt like this was a story that could be useful, and that I was the only one who could tell it.
But how do you deal with the fact that he's in this high position? You probably have to be sensitive to and respect that position. So I'm guessing you couldn't share everything or wouldn't want to share everything. Or, I mean, how did that work? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, if you ask me questions about what he and I talk about together, I'll probably say no thanks.
Okay, good. I'm going to, by the way, but we'll get to there. But okay. Yes.
No, I mean, I try to respect the confidence that we have in our conversations together, and I know he does as well.
There's a preface in the book. It says this. It says, in many ways, Tom's story is a love story. The love of parents for children of parents, of siblings for each other, and of saints, leaders, and members in the Lord's church for one another. But it seems to have left out what seemed to be one of the central love stories.
The biggest love story.
The biggest love story. Yeah. The love story between you and your partner.
Right. Yeah, for 19 years, that was the love story of my life. Yeah.
You decided to say very little about him.
Right.
You don't even name him in the book. You just refer to him as your partner. You don't say much about the relationship. You make references to it. It's not as if you pretend it didn't exist. Why do it that way, I guess, is the question.
For his privacy.
Yeah.
You know, really, I really felt like the story that I wanted to tell could only be my story. And so, you know, he's a huge part of it, but he needs to tell his own story if he ever wants to. And so I shouldn't be telling his.
What did Deseret Book or the church figure was the intent of this? The preface says this: this book opens new dimensions to the dialogue about homosexuality and other gender-related issues so prevalent in today's society. What do they mean, new dimensions? And what is what do they want to get out of this?
Well, my feeling has been that, you know, I really wanted to start a new conversation. That, you know, for too long it's been the far ends of either side yelling at each other. And I think there's a productive conversation to be had in the middle, and especially with members of wards and families when a kid comes out. And I felt like my parents' experience, our experience as a family, isn't a blueprint for anybody else, but it could at least give some good ideas of ways that, you know, barriers are not erected and that love remains constant and grows.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that a ward can be welcoming and accepting of someone who comes through the door without demanding that they see repentance or they see progress, but simply be grateful that somebody chooses to come and worship with them. So that's my hope, is that we really have that kind of a conversation. And my feeling has been with Deseret Book that they've been very aligned with that conversation, that we can be much more loving in our engagement and find ways not only to understand each other, but really to empathize with each other and to be more Christian.
I was surprised at how scriptural it is. You peg a lot of the way you're thinking about this directly to scripture. And it sounds very much like it was written by an active Latter-day Saint, which you are.
Right.
But that surprised me a little bit. I mean, it's very scriptural. It's very connected to that. That surprised me. I'm not sure why.
That's because it's something I've really had to wrestle with for the last 10 years.
Yeah.
But really, you know, what is my place? How can I have a great desire to be Christian. I have a great desire to be a disciple. So how can I find a place to do that? And so I turn to scriptures to give me answers.
There's this kind of disclaimer you write in the introduction where you point out that you're writing from a personal perspective. And you say, I hope an LDS writer will take up the task to educate all of us on the challenges and the nuances and the joys of life in which gender clarity cannot be taken for granted. So you're saying, I hope someone else does that, but you don't think that's what you're doing in this book?
My focus is really on sexual identity, and gender identity is something that I haven't wrestled with. So I have a lot of friends who are transgender, and I admire them immensely, but they need to tell the story. They need to educate all of us. I think they walk the most difficult path.
Who's the book for?
When I first started writing it, I thought I was writing it to parents of kids as they came out. And then as I got going, I thought I was writing it to members of congregations. And then I thought I was writing it maybe to adult LGBTQ people.
Yeah.
And by the time I finished, I actually decided I hoped I was writing it to people who are active attenders at church and may not have had a family member who's gay or transgender, and so they haven't wrestled with it, that this might be a way to introduce them to things they haven't thought about in a way that hopefully would encourage a really loving response.
There's a story that you tell in the book. You knew you were gay when you were really young, like 5 years old. How did a five-year-old make sense of that?
I don't know that I did make sense.
Really,
of it.
Really. But I knew something was different
in a response to a situation between me and my older brothers.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what it was, but I just somehow knew that I was different. And then it wasn't until I was in junior high that, and some kid called me a homo, that I went to the library to look up what that meant and went, oh, well, in fact, he's right. I am homo. Yeah. And so that's where I finally had language to describe the difference that I've been feeling.
When you saw it defined in a dictionary,
right?
Did that terrify you, sadden you? What did you? How did you react?
You know, it really was something that I felt like, okay, now I know, but I can't talk to anybody about this. And so my approach was to pray about it and ask God to take this away from me so that I would never have to talk to anybody about it. It was my shameful secret.
Yeah. Cure me, God.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You figure you're going to pray to God to hopefully get rid of it.
Right.
What do you figure is going to be your life at that point? Did you map out what that was going to mean for your life at that point?
No.
No.
I still thought I was going to be the good Mormon boy. You know, go on a mission, get married at the temple, have kids, and, you know, somehow this was all going to work out.
How religious was your family?
Very.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Scripture reading, those kinds of things,
family
prayer.
Family home evening. And
the whole thing.
Prayer in the morning, reading scriptures before we went to school, the whole thing.
So you went on a mission.
Yep.
And you've talked about how you enjoyed your mission.
I did. Wayne and Marlene Owens were my mission presidents, and they
let me remind people who don't remember Wayne Owens, of course, Congressman Wayne Owens.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And they were just amazing people and so wonderful in their ability to embrace everyone, which set a great example for, you know, some aspirations I have for my life.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, it was a time when I could be wholly dedicated to something, work in complete unanimity with other people who had the same objective, right? That we were totally connected. And so it was a time of great love, you know, people I worked with, you know, other missionaries, as well as members of the church where I was working and people that we were teaching. And so to me, it was really a wonderful time. And I didn't have to worry about being gay
really. In
those 2 years. So it just wasn't something I was dealing with. And so therefore, I thought this deal I had made with God before I went
was working.
That if I did my best, you know, this would disappear.
Yeah.
And when I got home and a week later saw some cute guy, I was like, well, wow, I guess that deal didn't work.
Yeah. I have to ask, what influence did Wayne Owens have on your political point of view? Did it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And my mother later in her life once said, you know, I've gotten used to the idea that you're gay, but do you have to be a Democrat?
Did you ever approach President Owens, Wayne Owens, with anything about your sexuality?
I didn't.
Didn't come up?
Didn't. We didn't. I moved to California quite soon after I got home off my mission.
Yeah.
And so we didn't have a lot of time to engage afterward, which I really regret.
You met a woman.
I did.
Fell in love.
I did.
Is that how you describe it?
Yes.
Yeah. And got married. Got married in the temple. You were all in at this point. And I'm wondering how you worked that out. If you, before you pulled the trigger on that decision, did you think, I shouldn't do this or I can't do this? Or, I mean, how did it work? You're thinking.
Magical thinking, I guess, is the phrase, right?
Yeah.
That somehow I figured if I did this thing that it would just miraculously work out. Before we were married, I did say, you know, I think I have tendencies.
Yeah.
But
that's what they said in those
exactly.
days, didn't they? Yeah.
And it, you know, that wouldn't have prepared her by any stretch for what was to come, and I didn't really understand what was to come either.
You write about telling your parents that before you came out as gay officially, you called to tell them that you were ending your marriage.
Right.
Would you tell that story?
I did. I had gone down to see my brother Greg, who was living not far from me in California, to tell him first. I thought I needed to try it out on a friendly audience. And we talked a bit about, you know, what I could say to mom and dad. So I'd prepared my introductory comments. They were living in Colorado. I called them, told them that we were separating. And the first question my mom had was, why?
Yeah.
And I hadn't quite prepared for that one. So I said, because I'm gay. And there was silence on the line.
And that's the first time you'd said it.
It was.
Yeah.
And she said then, well, I guess we've always known. And I thought to myself, well, why in the world haven't we been talking about this? But, you know, it was hard for them. You know, their initial reaction was that there was something they'd done wrong. You know, my dad was convinced for a while that because he'd traveled so much in his career, he was a veterinarian who did product research and development, that I didn't have a male influence and therefore that's what turned me gay.
Yeah.
And, you know, fortunately he got over that and then they...
But that was a lot. There was a lot of thinking like that at the time,
was.
Right?
I mean, really, it's so cruel, I think, where psychology was at that point that somehow parents were responsible for this. You know, and it's clearly they're not. You know, I mean, I think having listened to Greg Prince recently on your show and then the speech that he gave for the university lecture, you know, the biology is quite clearly emerging as the cause. Right. And so just to think that people felt guilty or were made to feel guilty is really appalling.
In the preface, it reads, the fact is there is so much that we simply don't know. Where does homosexuality originate? Why does it even exist? What are its causes? Those are the questions posed in the preface, not written by you.
Right.
Are you on board with that? I mean, don't we know? I mean, I know we know there's some, we know it may not be, quote unquote, completely biological, that there's some epigenetics involved.
Right.
We know that it's environment in some ways, but it's also, as you say, biological.
Right.
How do you explain it?
I would agree that, you know, science hasn't uttered the last word, right? That we don't have a definitive explanation of every aspect. But you'd, I certainly would say that the plurality of what's going on, you know, that we're settling into quite a pretty solid view that genetics and epigenetics are key determinants. And so, you know, I think we're coming to a better understanding than we've had, even if we're not fully at that place yet.
I guess what caught me up by that preface is it's asking, it seems like it's saying, gosh, we don't really know, which seems to suggest to me that the church is still struggling to come right out and, in fact, say it's biology. They do in so many words. You hear it from time to time, but this is still tough for them, I guess it seems.
I mean, I really appreciated in the first version of MormonsandGays.org, now MormonandGay.LDS.org, the phrase in there that no one chooses this attraction. You know,
it's a big step.
It is a big step. And I think at least we've come to that place. Right, you know, whatever causation may be, it wasn't simply that someone thought, "Oh, this would be fun. I think I'll be gay."
Yeah. There's a kind of a section in the book where you define your terms, and this is what you write. You write, "Gay is the word that you use to encompass some core elements of how I see and engage the world." What do you mean by that? Because it seems like what you're saying is, I don't just want to be defined by my sexuality, even though it's a core element of who I am.
Right.
Is that right?
It's one of many definitions of who I am. I agree.
Yeah.
You know, but it's a pretty critical one. And what I was trying to say there was really draw a distinction between sexual behavior and sexual identity. Right, that it isn't all about sex, that it's about the way I see and relate to the world, the experiences that I have in it. And it's bigger than just sexual behavior. But so many times I think people who are not used to this hear the word gay and think, oh, that means you're out having sex with everyone you can find and whatever else they think a gay lifestyle means, you know, as opposed to the more comfortable term for some of same-sex attraction or same-gender attraction, which to me fails to really describe in any breath what I feel.
We'll come back to this question of sex.
Okay.
Because you have to ask it. Can you be fully realized as a gay person and not be allowed to physically express sexual pleasure?
I think it ends up being really a very personal decision.
Yeah.
And you know, let's be really frank that, you know, I came to that decision when I was about 55. So I'm old, but not that old. Yeah. it's not like that isn't still a great desire. But I think there's a time and season in life, and also that at some point, if this is the path one's going to choose, it's because of an inner feeling, not an external demand. At least that's how I've come to see it.
What do you mean?
I mean, it for me, it had to be something that I felt was going to be beneficial to me in my life and achieve some objectives in my life, not that I was trying to follow dictates that somebody outside had said I needed to do.
The other part, how much is the Christian Mormon part of your core? How much does that make up the way you identify yourself?
The bulk, I would say.
Really?
Yeah, I feel like my desire to really be Christian. Somebody used the phrase that, you know, if somebody accused you of being Christian, would they find enough evidence in your life to convict you, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I hope I could be convicted. So it is a driving force in my life.
You describe yourself as a happy gay Mormon.
Right.
As if that was a novelty?
I think for some people it is. I think for some people it's hard enough to wrap their arms around gay Mormon, let alone happy gay Mormon. I also say that I was a happy gay non-Mormon.
Yeah. But are you happy with the parts of your life that seem constrained by the Mormon part? You can't have sexual relations. You can't get married. You would probably be discouraged from having children. I mean, those are big things.
Yeah, I think.
And yet you're still happy.
I think we have to honestly say that elemental desire, that just deep, deep instinctual desire to have a unique other to love and be loved, never goes away. You know, that's a critical part of life. I'm grateful I had the chance to experience it and learn from it. And it doesn't go away.
Yeah.
So there are some nights are harder than others.
That seems sad to me.
But there are also, I have found, at least, that there are compensations. And it's partially it's love of friends and family who care for me and look out for me. But mostly for me, it's being able to accomplish goals that I have in my religious life.
It's Tom Christofferson. His book is called That We May Be One. On Thursday night at 7, he's going to be part of a panel discussion at Libby Gardner Hall on the campus of the University of Utah. He'll be joined by Bruce Larson and Dave Checkitz. Both were Christofferson's ecclesiastical leaders when he was rebaptized. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Tom Christofferson is joining us. We're talking about his new book. He calls it A Happy Gay Mormon's Perspective on Faith and Family. The book is called That We May Be One. You have an abiding love for your folks, your parents. It really comes through in the book. And you write this, it was no easier for them to have a gay son than it would be for any other LDS parent. So I want to ask about that. You were referring to it a bit earlier. You talk about how they showed extraordinary compassion and empathy, but that they had difficulties trying to figure this out. What were some of the difficulties at first? Because you talked about you went through a rough part where maybe you even stopped speaking for a time because like, Mom and Dad, I can't talk to you guys about this. Is that part of
that? I don't think
work?
We stopped speaking, but for a time I think we were speaking past each other.
Yeah.
You know, I couldn't really express to them why this felt so critical to me, that I needed to understand what it meant to be gay, and why I couldn't figure out at that point how to be gay and Mormon.
Yeah.
And they couldn't figure out why something they knew had been important to me suddenly seemed to no longer exist. So, you know, I would say it took a year or two for us to really find our footing in the new normal.
Yeah.
And in large measure it was because they wanted so badly and I wanted so badly for us to remain connected and to have that tie that we'd always had.
Was there a breakthrough moment or
series? You know, in one sense, it's in a story that I relate in the book that we were having a family reunion about 2 years after I came out.
This was the cabin?
Yes.
Yeah, okay,
yes.
Good. All right.
So I had announced that I was going to bring the guy I was dating at the time, and that caused concern with some of my brothers and sisters-in-law about their young kids.
Yeah.
And so my parents sort of brokered a deal. They said, called me up. I was living in L.A. and said, we won't ask you to do this again, but this once, would you just come by yourself for 2 days so that we have a night in between that we can all be together and talk about this?
Yeah. Let's work this out.
And I said, yes. And
But did you say yes right away, or you were like, screw that? I mean, were you ever defiant in your life about that? Like, this is who I am, guys.
Yeah.
I need to bring – why shouldn't I? And maybe you were – I can even imagine you being a little upset at your brothers and their wives about, really?
Right.
You don't want to bring your kids to the cabin because I'm going to be with my gay boyfriend?
So that those moments had come earlier
okay,
in the process.
Okay.
So they did exist. Oh, my gosh, yes.
Yeah,
and it was
–
And, you know, and if I'm totally honest, I have to say my boyfriend had no desire to come. So
I don't want to come to your stupid family reunion in a cabin where there are 1,000 people.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, to me, I was making this political stand that he had to be invited.
Yeah.
But he didn't want to come. So, you know, and by that point, it was fine. So I did. Yeah. And after we'd put all the kids to bed, we went into mom and dad's room in the cabin and had a family prayer. And then dad talked about what he really thought was critical, which was that we would be loyal and have unity, that we would remain loyal to each other regardless of what would happen in our lives, and that we'd be unified as a family. And then our mom said, you know, I'm embarrassed to say it, but I thought we had the perfect Mormon family when you boys were little.
I want to underline that because I think that's such an important thing to say. Yeah. She said, I'm embarrassed to say I thought we had the perfect Mormon family. Just explain that, because I think that's a really important point.
You know, I think she thought it was all fixed. We had all the answers and, you know, everything was going to proceed perfectly and we were not going to have any challenges in life. And I think the embarrassment is, well, of course that's not the case, right? And as she then said, you know, there is no perfect Mormon family or perfect family. But then she said, you know, I really feel like we can be perfect in our love for each other. And then she turned to my brothers and their wives and said, you know, the most important lesson that your kids will learn from the way our family treats Uncle Tom is that nothing that they can ever do will take them outside the circle of our family's love. And that was the breakthrough moment, really. That was the point that changed the direction of how we were going to work and deal with each other for the rest of our time together.
You say in the book that your parents were wise in that they managed to, and this is how you put it, ensure that you and your partner – ultimately the partner that you became involved with for almost 20 years, that you and your partner were fully integrated into the family.
Right.
Like fully?
Yes.
Like go to Thanksgiving dinner together.
Right.
When you have gatherings in the family, you sleep in the same bed, all of that?
All of that. So we were really fortunate in that both of our families treated us the same way, that they were really, you know, and in a sense, by the way, I have to say, I think for my parents, as they came to know my partner, I think there was an element of relief for them because they could see that I was happy and they could see that I had a stable life. So some of the things that they might have worried about before could go away. And he is just the most, you know, magnificent person, and they fell in love with him.
Yeah.
It was easy to love.
All your brothers loved him?
Yes. Yeah.
I love you mentioned that your mom, she got to the point where she had this kind of great sense of humor about the fact that, and I love this because it seems like she's really embracing the fact she was wearing this great blue outfit one day, and I'm guessing you may have helped her, and somebody said, oh, that looks great. And she said, oh, you just need to get a gay son, and then you'll have a really great wardrobe, which I think that conveys something about the way she conveyed her relationship with you. Right?
It does. It made me feel that she had a level of comfort that she could joke about it. But also at their 60th anniversary, we asked them what they wanted to do to celebrate it. For their 50th, we'd thrown a big party and there were 500 people, whatever. And for their 60th, they said they just wanted to have the boys and their spouses and mom and dad. So the 12 of us for dinner. And we did that and then had a photograph taken. So that was blown up to great size and hung over the fireplace in their family room for the rest of their lives. So anybody who came in their home, and mom and dad made no secret of they had five boys, could count six. You know, and that was a powerful thing. You know, I think they were not embarrassed. I think they were happy to share that this was their family, including my partner.
How did they react when you said, I can't make this work as a Mormon and as a gay man, and you went and asked to be excommunicated?
Yeah.
Like, how did they react? They must have been deeply disappointed.
Devastated.
That. Yeah, devastated.
I mean, it really was a blow to the core of everything they held critical in their lives. And, you know, here I was essentially turning my back on it. But for me, I really felt like if I was going to be honest, if I was going to have any integrity in this process, I couldn't sort of just not go to church. I needed to not be a member of it.
Why?
Because I felt like the standards of the church, you know, the covenants that are made in the temple, I wasn't going to keep. And I didn't want to feel like I was kind of saying I was doing one thing and actually doing another.
There's a kind of integrity that seemed consistent, not just with your religious or family life, but also in your professional life. I mean, you hid this fact that you were gay for a while, but it seems like at some point, I mean, you write, shame is an awful corrosive thing. And it seems like you came to this point where you're like, look, this is who I am, and I'm going to share this, not just with my family, but right. in my professional life too.
Right. And it was a progressive thing. Hmm. You know, when I in the first place I was working where I was playing with pronouns and pretending that he was actually she.
Yeah. Like, what did you do on the weekend? Oh, and the she.
My friend and I.
Yeah.
She did this.
Right.
And it's awful. Because and people know you're hiding something. You know, they may not figure out what it is, but there's just a sense that you're not being upfront. And so when I changed companies I worked for, I decided I was going to be honest with anyone who asked. So I wasn't necessarily going to put it out there, but if anybody said, so what'd you do this weekend, then they were going to hear about my boyfriend and I.
Yeah.
And then progressively it became that I was going to put it out there. You know, frankly, that I was going to just say, oh, you know, my partner and I went on such a great trip this weekend, we blah, blah, blah. And I also found, because my profession has largely been sales and client management, that if I inserted a quick comment early in a relationship with a client, that it would prevent embarrassing moments later on. And by that, I mean moments when a client would be embarrassed if they'd said something.
Yeah.
I worried about that at first because I thought, well, it's not my company. Is it really my place to insert this into a client relationship? But I really discovered that, you know, the point of these relationships is that you become close, right? There's trust built up between you, and you really to have a strong relationship, and therefore they needed to know that I was being honest.
You and your partner never did get married.
No.
Why is that?
You know, when we were first together, that wasn't a possibility.
Yeah, of course.
When we moved to Connecticut in 2007, they had just begun having civil unions.
Civil unions, right. Yeah.
And then later changed that to be called marriage, but it was civil union. And we talked about it. And, you know, I think we let ourselves get hung up in the details of how it would work. My partner's parents were divorced when he was quite young. And his father and mother had a difficult time being in the same room even then. And my oldest brother had been called as a general authority, and I didn't want to embarrass him.
So that was part of it.
But I didn't want to exclude him.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think we thought through all that and tried to figure out how we would make it work and just kind of never did it.
You and your partner, I mean, there is always this spiritual longing, it seems, certainly for you. And it seems like even for him to some degree.
I think so.
So you tried other churches.
Yep.
But nothing really stuck. And in fact, you say in the book that one of the things that you felt like was missing, and I'll quote you here, was the theology of restoration.
Right.
What do you mean?
And I mean that, you know, what I grew up with, the theology I best understand, which is the LDS Church and restoration of priesthood authority in the church, makes sense to me at a very deep level and in a way that other doctrines or theologies that I studied didn't.
That really surprises me on some level, because I would figure you would say, oh gosh, I can get deep empathy and compassion from any number of churches. But the thing that you kind of felt missing was the authority thing, it's that thing that I wouldn't think you would have any affection for almost on some level. You know what I mean?
I do. And at a point where you know, I was quite seriously considering joining the church again,
yeah.
the LDS church.
Yeah.
My partner and I had a conversation. We had many. But at one time he said to me, if you will pick a church that would be supportive of our relationship, I'll go with you every week.
Yeah.
And it was a heartbreaking moment because I didn't feel I could make that choice. To me, this is where I find truth. And I didn't feel I could make a different choice.
This is the heart-wrenching part of your story, I have to say. Because you, in fact, you even say in the book that you can understand how your partner would have believed that you had chosen the church, the LDS church, over him.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what you did. Is that a crass way to put it?
No, it's a fair way to put it. In my mind, I had always thought that I could do both.
Yeah.
That I might have to give up the physical relationship that we enjoyed, mm-hmm. but at least could keep the emotional, intellectual, and every other connection that we had. And maybe I felt like that was a doable thing because we'd had so much of our lives together. We'd been through so much. We'd had ups and downs, and we had a history, and I felt like that could connect us, even if we weren't able to fully enjoy our relationship with
each
other.
So wait, you thought that in some way you would get rebaptized, become a Latter-day Saint, which you figured meant you'd have to be celibate. You couldn't have a sexual relationship with another man.
Right.
And that in some way you could, because this seems kind of delusional. I'm sorry to put it that way, but I mean, is he going to go along with this? Look, I want to keep you as a partner forever, but we can't right. have sexual pleasure anymore.
Well, I've already told you I'm guilty of magical thinking. Right?
No,
I felt like that was such a powerful, rewarding element that it was worth keeping.
Our
emotional connection.
Yeah.
You know, that would be worth keeping for both of us, even without the physical part of it. But,
right.
you know, we had stopped having physical relationships a bit before in order that I could be baptized.
Wow.
But
so he was on board for a while.
For a while.
I think we can
really felt like after I'd been baptized and a few months after, we were still living in the same house. And he said, you know, this isn't happy for me.
Yeah.
And I was okay to do it for a while, but it's not something I want to do for the rest of my life. And I tried all sorts of crazy things like, well, what if I'd been in a car accident? And, you know, that wasn't even a possibility. Would you just leave me then? And he looked at me like I was an idiot and said, why would you say things like that?
Yeah.
That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about, you know, we do. It's a choice we're making.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's a choice for happiness for me. But, you know, earlier he had said to me, because I felt I'd made commitments to him and I wasn't free to make any other commitments because of that.
Right.
But over a period of years, as we talked about it, and he came to a point where he said, look, I think you need to do what's going to be the right thing for you, and then I'll have to figure out what's best for me. And I just felt like, you know, that is the most loving thing anyone could ever say, right? That I'm willing for my life to be disrupted or for things to change that I value because I want you to do what you think is best for yourself.
Must have been hard.
Yeah. Yep. Still is.
Really?
Yeah. I found out last Christmas that he had met someone and that, you know, had to let go of the fantasy that somehow we were going to be able to find a way to be together again. The person I love most in the world and my closest friend, and had to realize that wasn't going to happen. But that next day after a sleepless night, I was sitting in church. It was a Sunday. And the thought came to me of, you know, you've been praying for 3 years that he would be happy. Mm-hmm. And if this is the answer to your prayers, then you need to be grateful. And I feel like that's right. He did the most loving thing he could for me. I need to do it for him. And I feel that way. I miss him incredibly, but I hope and pray that he is incredibly happy and that this is just the greatest life he could imagine.
It's Tom Christofferson. His book is called That We May Be One, A Gay Mormon's Perspective on Faith and Family. On Thursday night, he's going to be part of a panel discussion on the campus of the University of Utah. You can get details about that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. ¶¶ This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Tom Christofferson. We're talking about his book, That We May Be One. Here are some more of the questions that come early in the book.
Okay.
What choices do those who identify as gay or lesbian have if they wish to remain faithful to gospel covenants? What is our Father's plans for these individuals in the eternities? How do you answer that? And you go through this in the book in a very clear way, I should say. You've come up with these kind of scriptural answers to those questions. And it seems like, in part, one of them is that the answer is that you won't get an answer right now, that for some reason God isn't going to give that answer to you, that you have to be, as you say, and this is a reference to a Mormon scripture, long-suffering, gentleness and meekness, love unfeigned, kindness and pure knowledge. So you don't know.
No.
You hope to know some point, where is my place, but for now you're just going to have to wait?
I do believe that more will come.
Yeah.
You know, the the articles of faith of the LDS Church, one of them says, we believe that God will yet reveal many great and important things pertaining to his kingdom. I believe that.
Yeah.
I think this is one of them. And I think we're at a moment where more and more faithful Latter-day Saints are praying that their hearts will be open, that God will tell us more, that we can understand more than whatever he might choose to say. And I believe leaders are searching for the right questions to ask. So I am convinced that we'll know more, but I don't know when or what. And I also, in the book, really try to talk about what we don't know.
Yeah.
So as we project what a next life will be, that there's so many things that might simply be our extension of our current experience that we think might be a part of that, but we don't know that. So my hope in that is that we can be open to many possibilities of what might await. And that probably what we do know is that the family of God is a critical component, that somehow there are relationships there among the family of God that are preserved.
Yeah.
And that's why we go to the temple, to seal the family of God together.
You write that it's your sense that your sense is that we are inclined to fill in many of the missing or hazy elements by extrapolating, and I guess that's what you were getting at, by extrapolating our earthly experiences and projecting them forward to the life eternal. And you say, it seems to me that many of the attributes that make me, me, are associated in my mind with being gay. And yet, without being able to grasp the nature of relationships in the eternal realm, how can I even know if the concept of being gay, the way I understand it today, would have any meaning in another realm? So it sounds like you're sort of pegging your hope on the fact that we all, you know, most Mormons probably think of the eternity as you get up and you have breakfast as a family or whatever it is. And you're like, maybe it doesn't quite work that way, that there may be some other. But I'm not even sure what that means, really.
Yeah, I have a hard time imagining Sunday dinner in the Celestial Mansion, right?
right.
since everyone is themselves a parent and a child and a grandparent and a grandchild and whatever else. So it, you know, that concept just doesn't make sense to me. But what I guess what I feel is that the first and second great commandments prepare us, at least in some sense, for what might lie ahead.
You know, explain that
it's our love for God the Father and his Son, our desire to follow them with all of our hearts and mights and minds and strength. And the second, that we love our neighbors as ourselves. And I really feel like in learning those kinds of love, that's what prepares us for whatever it might be that lies ahead.
Hmm. You write that as lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, or same-sex attracted members of the Church of Jesus Christ, we live in the reality of two independent contradictory truths. The first is that we're children of God. The second is this, that God's prophets have said that what comes naturally to us, what feels like is at the core of our being, must not find physical expression. And then you ask, how will we go forward with that reality?
Right.
How will you go forward with that reality? Because what you seems like the conclusion you've come to is that in order for me to reconcile those two things, I have to just give in to the physical part. I can't have that physical part.
Right.
Is that right?
Yeah, and this is probably as good a moment as any to say, this is my answer for me.
Yeah.
Right? The one thing I've worried so much about the book, because it's published by Deseret Book, because of my last name, that somehow it would be seen as this is the answer for everyone. You know, that everybody needs to follow this path, and I don't believe that.
Yeah.
I've really tried to follow where I feel I've been guided, and that's being true to the, you know, the journey for me. And I hope everybody else will do it in their way, where they feel way they feel they are guided, and whatever, however that plays out for them. And I, you know, I love and support whatever choices they're making and doing the very best they can with their lives. But for me, it's been learning a process of living by daily bread. You know, the notion of being present, that I can't simply focus on what might be in the future. What I can do is focus on what I can do today. You know, how can I be a better disciple?
Yeah.
What can I do that's going to make a difference in the world? How can I try to learn and understand more?
This is going to sound like a dumb question, but do you feel lonely?
I'm not sure why that's a dumb question.
Well, I don't mean to oversimplify it as if to say you're wanting or something, but it does seem like, I'm sure you have great vibrant relationships with friends and family, right. And when you all get together, I imagine it's wonderful, but
there is always that lack of the singular
saying.
Other.
Yeah.
It's true.
It's true what? That you feel lonely?
It's a conversation I've had with single friends, you know, some of my straight women friends who remain unmarried about that, and, you know, I think all of us would say that there are moments when you get that anxiety attack, the panic attack of, oh boy, is this, you know, what's going to happen when I'm old and gray and sick?
Yeah.
Who's going to be there to take care of me?
Yeah.
And I, you know, that's real. It's a real worry. And so I think all we can do is keep moving forward today and trust that there will be answers in the future as I find answers today. But it's real.
You write about being in California on business on November 5th of 2015. Mm-hmm. It's the day the news of this new church policy broke. And it's a policy I don't think remind people of. It's a decision that was made by the church to basically declare people in same-sex marriages apostates and deprive their children from the blessings and membership of the church. You got news of it. You say you were stunned by it. Couldn't wrap your mind around it. You texted your brother, Elder Christofferson, to say what? Is this true?
Could this possibly be true?
Yeah.
I'm hearing these rumors. I can't imagine it's true. What's going on? And he said, yes, it is true.
Were you angry?
I think I would just say I was dumbfounded.
Yeah.
I couldn't wrap my head around it. I don't love the notion that the people that I love are called apostates. But it was really the piece about children and having to delay ordinances until they reach their majority that I couldn't understand, because it felt to me like the sins of the parents, if you want to say it that way, were being delivered to the heads of the children. And, you know, that's not congruent with anything I understand about Christ's teaching or the gospel. So, you know, and that chapter in the book was probably the hardest chapter to write, and I think reflects, you know, the two streams in my head and heart, right?
Yeah.
That my experience in my life with married gay couples, some have children, some don't, is that is a great stabilizer of the relationship. But there's just some psychic element about being married that somehow makes it a deeper commitment and more meaningful. And so from a societal perspective, I think that's magnificent and wonderful and a benefit.
Yeah.
So I've got that of my personal experience says this is a great thing. And yet I also believe that prophets, seers, and revelators can see what I cannot. And so I'm willing to say, all right, that they may see something I don't. And so I'm sort of left in the middle of saying, I can't really reconcile this. I don't understand it. So I keep trying to understand it. I keep praying about it. I keep studying and and with the hope that someday I'll have clarity about it.
Well, Tom, one option, of course, is that this is that these prophets, seers, and revelators are seeing something you're not. The other option, of course, is that you had a leader suffering from dementia at the time, 88 years old, and in a moment of pique or possibly confusion, had this policy drawn up and approved, and that, in fact, it wasn't God's intent. It was just a very mortal mistake. Don't you think about that as being a possibility?
But then you have Elder Nelson's comments a few months later that categorize it as revelation.
Yeah. Well, and you can choose to believe whether or not, in fact, it was God's call to do that.
Right.
It sounds like you do believe that. Do you?
It's a hard question. I guess I do believe that people that I sustain as being called of God have called it revelation, and I'm willing to follow that.
You don't really want to answer that question, do you?
I don't have a good answer for it. I still struggle with it.
What you had an exchange with your brother. We don't have to say much about it. I'll just mention what you mentioned in the book. Mm. He said to you, if you have to distance yourself from me, I will understand. What do you think that meant?
He had just recorded the interview the day following when people became aware of the policy change, and had recorded that interview with the head of public affairs at the time, and said, you know, we've just finished it, and I don't think it's going to be satisfactory to anyone. And if you feel you need to distance yourself from me, I will certainly understand. And I felt like what he was saying was, you know, I realize the position that I'm in. Right, that these people that I love so dearly will be hurt. And I said to him, look, this can't have been easy for you to have a gay brother who doesn't shut up. And you've never distanced yourself from me. And I certainly won't distance myself from you.
You probably can't answer this, but I need to ask, can you say he was upset by the policy?
I can't answer that.
Yeah. It's been suggested that the policy came in an unusual way, that it wasn't vetted like it usually is, that the 12 weren't invited to really discuss it, just expected to kind of ratify it. Can you say anything about that?
I mean, I've read what Greg Prince and Kendall Wilcox have put together, but I don't have any independent knowledge of it.
Can you say anything about whether or not there are factions within the Quorum of the 12, a group that might be opposed to where this policy ended up or where it went?
Yeah, I don't have any knowledge of that.
Some members of the church, you write, were able to immediately feel that the policy was appropriate. Others struggled, and some continue to do so. Where are you?
Continuing to do so. I have had people I love dearly who have felt they needed to exit the church as a result. Families, whole families have left. And so, you know, that breaks my heart. And I find it very hard to reconcile how this can be something that builds the kingdom when I see people I love so much taking themselves away from it.
Do you think the policy has changed? I mean, there's a story that you tell we didn't even have the time to get to, but where you have this great bishop in Connecticut and you are nervous, you're driving around, you open the book, in fact, you're driving around the block trying to screw up the courage to go in and talk to him because you want to come back.
Right.
And long story short, he says, Tom, of course, come back and bring your partner. Come back to church.
Right.
We'd love to see you guys. And in fact, your ward was awesome.
They really were.
Right? I mean, so you show up and you go and you come and, you know, he's not sure what to make of it. He's not a Mormon, but he comes sometimes. And, and now I'm trying to imagine that circumstance after this policy.
Yeah. I said to someone, I think I had the shortest honeymoon on record.
Yeah.
Coming back to church and then coming so soon on the heels. But that, you know, it's actually Prop 8 that was the turning point for my partner.
Right. He was like,
yeah, he really felt I had a brother and a few nephews and a niece who lived in California. And I don't remember how now, but somehow he came to discover that one of them had voted in favor of the proposition, which was then to overturn marriage.
Yes.
And he came to feel that these people that he loved and felt loved him and accepted him, perhaps were really just very well-mannered, and that it wasn't really a genuine acceptance. And that was so hard because I have a, again, this view of prophets, seers, and revelators that he really didn't share.
Yeah.
So I could understand why family members would feel that they needed to follow counsel they'd received, even though they absolutely loved us and accepted us. But that was not something that he could really understand.
Let me ask you, when people come to you and ask you what to do, that there's part of them that, like you, feels deeply Mormon.
Right.
You love going, you love singing hymns, you get all the stories, you want that part. But then there's the other part of them that wants to feel loved, that wants to get married
right.
to someone of the same sex. They want that kind of joy and relationship. I mean, you've talked about already how this is just your story, but
right.
what do you say to others, if you can even share that? What do you tell them?
I really say do the best you can to live close to the Spirit so that you have guidance to help you in decisions that you make.
So you think God is going to help you make that decision?
Sure. And I think you make the best decision you can at each point in your life. And that includes what's the best decision for my physical and emotional health.
Yeah.
You know, what's the best decision for helping me to continue to pursue spiritual goals in my life? And make the best decision you can and move forward. And if at other points you feel you need to make different decisions, you will. But I really believe in a perfect judge, right, who knows everything about us, including the desires of our hearts and the circumstances of our lives and our DNA and all the other things that we've talked about, biology, chemistry, and everything, that all of that is known to him, and he understands why we've made the decisions that we've made and our great desires. And I believe in many cases we'll have the opportunity to realize our desires in this life, maybe not, but we do the best we can. And I really do believe that most people are doing the best they can, wherever they are.
It's Tom Christofferson. His book is called That We May Be One, A Gay Mormon's Perspective on Faith and Family. On Thursday night at 7, he's going to be part of a panel discussion at the University of Utah's Libby Gardner Hall. You can get details about that on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Kelsey Moore produces our films. We had technical direction from Tim Slover. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.